It's a great pleasure to welcome Rachel Reed. Can people hear if I talk like this, or do I need to talk more loudly? Not quite sure. Yes, that's good. Okay. So this is organised by the Government Department and the Women in Politics group of the Student Union. And it's all part of a real push in the LSE to really lift up women's contribution to politics into something which is a major question of study. And the work, the biography of Alice Bacon, which Rachel wrote, is a very sort of symbolic of this, because Alice Bacon was really one of the absolute key figures in the Labour Party through the 1950s and the 1960s, indeed through the 1940s, the 1950s and the 1960s. But she sort of almost airbrushed out of the histories of the Labour Party in that hugely formative period. So this seems such a marvellous opportunity now to get Rachel to come here with nearly a centenary of the first big move in women's suffrage, and nearly a centenary of the first woman MP, Nancy Astor, just after the First World War. So to be able to pull Rachel away from her parliamentary duties is exactly the right thing for us to be doing now. She's also, I should say, how she does all the things she does. By the way, we'll come on to this, because I simply can't understand how brilliantly organised she must be to do this. She's also writing now a book on 100 years of women MPs. Let me just say a few words about I should say my splendid career, your splendid career. So very first of all, she was the girls under 13 chess champion.
That's going back a bit. How long are we gonna be here?
So, PP at Oxford, MSc in economics here, and then went to work in the Bank of England. So she goes into politics as a top-class economist, of which there are rather few around in politics at the moment. Elected for Leeds West in 2010, she was immediately sort of promoted by Ed Miliband, first to be the Shadow Chief Secretary of the Treasury, which is a absolutely key position. I wish we had a really good one at the moment. And then Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, and decided not to serve in the Shadow Cabinet after the 2015 elections, but instead of that, she's the chair of the BICE, the Business, Energy and Innovation Department. select committee in the House of Commons, which is a really important position to have. Ludicrously Labour family. Her sister is a Labour MP. She's married to a Labour MP.
Not me. Ellie, not me. I'm not married to a Labour MP.
No, I know.
Thank God.
So Rachel is married to a strictly neutral top civil servant who just happened to be Gordon Brown's advisor and speechwriter, and has to, I'm sure, quite strain to behave as a proper... Oh, no, that's the most inappropriate thing to say. Anyway, you live in a completely Labour environment, and so your ability to write this book or to delve into the way the Labour Party worked through this period is fantastic. So I probably should apologise for the fact that that I'm a man, all I can say is I really wanted to do this because this is, if I was in America, I would say, meet the next president of the United States sort of thing, whatever you say. Anyway, this, to finish this introduction, which is getting a little bit out of control at the moment, Rachel.
Thanks, David. Thanks for that very kind introduction, David. And it's great to have you chair it for two reasons. First of all, I spent quite a lot of time as an undergraduate reading Macroeconomics and the Wage Bargain by you and Wendy Carlin, so everything I don't know about economics is your fault. And secondly, because David Soskis is the son of Frank Soskis, who was the first Labour Home Secretary under Harold Wilson, and Alice Bacon was his Minister of State for 2 years at the Home Office. And I'll say a little bit more about Frank later on when I speak, but I hope that reading the book and this evening will bring back some happy memories for you as well. As David remarked at the beginning, it was 1919 when the first woman was elected. The first woman took her seat in Parliament. I have to phrase that very carefully because the first woman was elected in 1918, Constance Markovitz, but she didn't take her seat in the House of Commons, partly because she was a Sinn Féin member of Parliament, elected as a Sinn Féin member of Parliament, but also because she was in Holloway Prison when she was elected, so it wasn't that easy for her to take her seat, even if she hadn't been inclined to do so. So the first woman to take her seat in the House of Commons was Nancy Astor in 1919. It took 26 years for Yorkshire and Leeds to get in on the Act, and in 1945, Alice Bacon was elected as the first woman to serve as a Member of Parliament in Leeds and indeed in the whole of Yorkshire. Alice Bacon was the 45th woman ever to be returned to Parliament, and when I was elected in 2010 I was the 360th. But the reason that this biography came about was because when I was elected in 2010 I was only the second woman ever to be elected for any of the 8 parliamentary constituencies in Leeds. Indeed, it took 65 years after Alice's election in 1945 for Leeds to elect its second woman, and that was me. And so when I stood up on the podium that night to make my acceptance speech after being elected as the Member of Parliament for Leeds West, I paid tribute, of course, to my immediate predecessor, but I also paid tribute to Alice Bacon, who was the only woman to have gone before me as a Leeds Member of Parliament. And I was very interested to try and find out more about Alice. I had some knowledge and some idea of her history and something of her achievements. But I felt, like David said, that she had in many ways been written out of history and forgotten in time. And I felt, and I feel very strongly, that every generation of women owes something to those who have gone before them, who have broken some of those glass ceilings, who have fought some of those battles, which make it a bit easier for those of us going out there today. And so I felt I did owe something to Alice Bacon, and so I wanted to find out a little bit more about how she became an MP in the first place. As I said, very few women returned to Parliament before Alice Bacon in 1945. What she did when she got there, how she approached being an MP, and what she achieved in those 25 years that she served in the House of Commons. And I'll tell you a little bit of that story this evening. So Alice was born in 1909 in Normanton in West Yorkshire, just outside of Leeds, and she was the only child of Benjamin and Lottie Bacon. And her father, Benjamin, was a coal miner in Normanton. He was also a very active Labour man, a trade union man as well. He was president of the Miners' Federation of Great Britain in Normanton, and he was also a county councillor on the West Riding County Council. And that was Alice's roots, really, in a very close-knit working class Labour party, but also, more importantly, Labour movement, trade union community. And her father was deeply embedded within that politics and in that community. And Benjamin wanted very much to pass on his politics, his love of politics and his love of Labour to his child. And he only had a daughter. And so he brought up Alice in that culture and in that environment. Alice spoke later about going down into the coal mine, down into the pit. She spoke about it actually in her maiden speech and the terrifying darkness that she experienced down there. Now, this was when she was about 13 or 14 years old, and I think it was very much her father wanting to show Alice what her family, what her community, and what their values were based on: hard work, labour, and that union as well. And that had a real impact, I think, on Alice. Alice spent most of her weekends as a teenage girl at the working men's clubs in Normanton. Her mum was making sandwiches in the kitchens, and her dad was either at meetings or giving advice and talking to his union members and also his constituents. And this is really where Alice, in a way, got her first taste of politics and the work that she was later going to do as a constituency MP. Because age 11, Alice got into the grammar school in Normanton. And for a working class girl in 1920, this was very unusual. But it opened up opportunities and experiences to Alice that most of the boys and girls who she grew up alongside in Normanton just didn't have. And again, Alice spoke later in life about how many of the boys and girls who she grew up within Normanton had deserved a grammar school education but had never had a chance of it. But one of the things that Alice got from her grammar school education was that she was well educated. She could read and write well. And that was a huge asset for the community in which she grew up, because she would spend her time then in the miners' clubs helping miners fill in forms for industrial injury and compensation, because many of them had left school very early without really being able to properly read and write. And so Alice's first casework was as a teenage girl at those working men's clubs. Age 16 then, Alice gives her first political speech, and that's in the Normanton Railway Men's Club. And it was a speech on behalf of a friend of her father's who was standing for the local council. Now, Alice, as a politician later in life as an MP, prepared meticulously for all of her speeches. She learnt the facts and the figures and the key arguments and rehearsed and debated them to herself beforehand. And this first speech that she gave age 16 was no different. And she'd been practising and learning this speech at home and rehearsing it to her mum and dad. But when she got to the room and saw the audience, she realised that the speech that she'd working on wouldn't do at all for the audience in front of her. So she decided she had to make up another speech off the top of her head. Now, her mum didn't know about this and was mortified when Alice stood up and started giving a speech entirely different from the one she'd been practising at home. And so her mum left the Railway Men's Club and walked around the perimeter of the building and only returned when she heard the applause for her daughter. And I think that tells us something about Alice's politics and her instincts and intuition and understanding of the community in which she grew up, but also then the type of community, Labour community, that she would then go on to serve as a Member of Parliament for 25 years. After this speech, a couple of years later, Alice got into teacher training college in London and she moved down south. But she was only here for a couple of years, and after teacher training, she returned to Normanton, where she taught at an interwar secondary modern school in the constituency, in the area. And although Alice had come from a very working class, humble background, she described never having experienced such poverty as what she saw as a school teacher in that school.
74% of the children who she taught were suffering from malnutrition. This was in about 1930, so the Great Depression, a time of huge poverty, and Alice really experienced that. And one of the things she did as a school teacher was set up a soup kitchen so that she took her class every lunchtime from the school to the social club at the end of the road, so she could ensure that the children she taught got at least one hot meal a day. And Alice also later went on to describe the double deprivation of children from poor communities growing up in poverty, physical poverty, but also that poverty of education, which meant instead of doors being opened to these young people, doors were being closed in their face, and the opportunities that she had from her education just weren't available to the vast majority of children in the community where she lived. And Alice decided when she was a school teacher that she had to do something about this. And for her, doing something about it meant becoming a politician. But that's still a huge leap from a young woman in her early 20s, despite growing up in a very political family and community. That leap then between thinking, I want to do something about it, I want to be a politician, to actually becoming a Member of Parliament was a huge leap. In 1930, probably only about 15 women had ever been Members of Parliament. But this was something that Alice set her sights on. And in 1938, she went for selection in the seat of Leeds North East, just a few miles from where she was living and where she grew up. Now, I interviewed many people for this book, and one of the people I interviewed was Gerald Kaufman. And Gerald Kaufman, although he went on to become a Member of Parliament in Manchester, he grew up in Leeds North East, and his parents had been members of the local party when Alice was selected to be the candidate in 1938. And what I was really intrigued to understand is how Alice had managed to win the parliamentary selection. I thought it was a very brave constituency party that had selected a young woman. She was only in her 20s at the time. And I asked Gerald this question, and he came back to me and said, "What you have to understand, Rachel, is that in 1938, this was a safe Conservative constituency. If Leeds North East had thought there was any chance of them electing a Labour Member of Parliament, they wouldn't have selected Alice Bacon or indeed any other young woman." And so it got me thinking that Alice's arrival and all the things she went on to achieve in politics in some ways was an accident of history. In 1935, at the general election, the seat of Leeds North East had a Conservative majority of more than 10,000. There's a 10-year gap then until the next general election, because, of course, in 1939, the Second World War came along and the election was postponed until after the war. And in those 10 years between 1935 and 1945, so much changed. The war, but in terms of politics, the Beveridge Report, and this very strong feeling amongst those who served in the armed forces, but also their families, that working people deserved something better than what they had experienced between the wars. And so in 1945, a Conservative government under Winston Churchill was transformed into a Labour government under Clement Attlee, and indeed a Labour landslide. And with that Labour landslide also came in a landslide of women. Because in 1935, there had been 8 women in Parliament, and in 1945, there were 24 women. And of those 24, 21 of them were Labour, 15 of them were elected for the first time in 1945. So 21 Labour women, one Conservative, one Liberal, and one independent woman in 1945. And of course, Alice was one of those 21 Labour and 15 newly elected Labour women. And then this also got me thinking about whether this was true for other women of that period as well. Was Alice the only one of those 15 who had been selected sort of by accident, or was that true for others? And in 1945, Blackburn was a two-member constituency. They returned two members of Parliament for the same constituency, Blackburn. And in 1935, that seat had one Conservative and one Labour MP. There was a sitting Labour MP, and he needed a running mate. But there was no expectation that that running mate was ever going to be returned to Parliament. So they selected a young woman called Barbara Betts, who then later went on to be Barbara Castle, and the rest, as they say, is history. So in many ways, it was an accident of history that these women came in 1945. But I would argue it was an accident of history that resulted in some great political and social change in this country. But it is similar in some ways to what happened in 1997, and to a lesser extent at the last general election just a few months ago. In 1997, 101 Labour women were elected, 120 women overall, but many of those Labour women in 1997 had been selected for seats that Labour hadn't expected to win. And so that Labour landslide, like in 1945, also ushered into Parliament a new generation of women MPs. So what was it like to be one of these women in 1945? Well, in 1918, when women were allowed to stand for Parliament for the first time, the parliamentary authorities realised that they needed to put these women somewhere. And so they created a room called the Lady Members Room, which was nicknamed by the early women in Parliament as the Dungeon, because of its location in Parliament, sort of underground, and it was also a quarter of a mile from the debating chamber. So it wasn't particularly accessible, and it wasn't a lovely environment in which to work. They set up 7 desks in the Lady Members' Room, and for over a year, none of them were occupied until Nancy Astor was elected, as I said, in 1919. And gradually, through the 20s and 30s, more women were being elected to Parliament. But by 1945, we had a whole 24 women MPs, but just 7 desks. And so there was talk of the women in Parliament being relegated to the corridors and the floors of the Palace of Westminster to do their work because there just wasn't enough room. Now, remember, at this time, places like the smoking room in Parliament, even some of the dining rooms, were not accessible to women. And while many men were members of clubs, those clubs, of course, didn't admit women. So there was very little space in Parliament for these women to work. Another woman elected in 1945, a Labour woman in Scotland called Jean Mann, described the Lady Members' Room as always looking like half an hour before the jumble sale was about to start, because strewn across it was newspapers and paperwork, but also hats and coats and bags and everything else, because this was the one place for the women to work. Despite being, in my view, a pioneer for the women's movement and for women, Alice, as with other women from that generation, didn't want to be regarded as women's MPs. Alice said that it would be a mistake to regard us as women MPs. We are here to do all the work that a man does, but then she added, and a little bit more. But they very much did not want to be pigeonholed. That said, Herbert Morrison, who was a mentor to Alice Bacon and a former deputy leader of the Labour Party, advised the women in Parliament, the Labour women, to stick to women's issues when they spoke in Parliament. And when Lena Jager, who you may remember, when she made her maiden speech on foreign policy, he wasn't best pleased. And by and large, the women did stick to domestic issues of welfare, of education and health. But certainly Alice was keen not to be regarded as a woman's MP. In those early years in Parliament, between 1945 and really up to the late 50s, Alice concentrated on issues to do with her constituency, particularly things of industrial injury, and she gave her maiden speech on that and spoke of the experience in Normanton, but also on housing squalor and the house building, the council house building programme, but particularly on education policy. Now, I remarked earlier that Alice had been to a grammar school, but Alice's political passion and the issue that she would champion more than anything else as a Member of Parliament was the issue of comprehensive education. And Alice always said that her support for comprehensive education didn't come from her membership of the Labour Party, but from her experience of teaching during the 1920s and 30s. And I think that was very true for Alice. It was that experience of being a school teacher herself and seeing that double deprivation, as she described it, that convinced her that you needed a comprehensive system of education so that all children from whatever their background and whatever their gender had that opportunity of an education that would open up opportunities for them. And in some ways, I think that she felt, despite, as I say, coming from a very humble background herself, that she had opportunities that most of her friends, people she grew up with, just hadn't had. And during the 1940s and 1950s, Alice spoke about comprehensive education in the Houses of Parliament more than any other member of Parliament. And she also used her position on the Labour Party National Executive Committee, so the ruling body of the Labour Party. And she was on that from 1939 all the way to 1970, so 31 years. She used her position on the Labour Party NEC as well to advocate for comprehensive education. Now, I like to think that my party, the Labour Party, is always on the progressive side of history, but actually on education policy in the 40s, even under Clement Attlee and a very radical Labour government, the welfare state, the National Health Service, the council house building programme, on education, and particularly on this issue of comprehensive education, the first Labour education secretary under Clement Attlee, Ellen Wilkinson, very much regarded as being on the left of the party, was pretty much supportive of the 1944 Education Act under Rab Butler, her predecessor, the Conservative Education Secretary. And the 1944 Education Act was to put in place a tripartite system of education of grammar, secondary, modern, and technical or vocational schools. And Ellen Wilkinson, who, like Alice, had been to a grammar school, felt that the grammar school had opened up opportunities for her, and she didn't want to close them down. Very different from Alice's experience, who said, the grammar schools has opened up opportunities, we want more people to have them. And so Alice was actually a thorn in the side, in many ways, of Labour education secretaries in the 40s and into the early 50s, as well as Conservative education secretaries through the 50s, constantly pushing them to go further and to abolish that tripartite system and to bring in comprehensive education. By 1964, Alice had achieved her goal to some extent in the 1964 Labour Manifesto under Harold Wilson, and the promise of the white heat of technology was also a commitment to comprehensive education, to open up those opportunities, as Wilson saw it. Wilson, of course, another grammar school boy. And so this was really a sort of culmination of the work of Alice and also other MPs during the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. Maybe talk a little bit later about Alice's politics and her involvement with Hugh Gaitskell, who was also her mentor and her next-door neighbour MP, and politically very close to Alice, both of them being on the moderate or the right of the Labour Party during some of those battles during the 40s and particularly in the 50s. But by 1964, after 13 years in opposition, Labour are back in government with Harold Wilson as Prime Minister, and with Frank Soskis as Wilson's first Home Secretary. And Alice in 1964 was given a job by Wilson as the Minister of State in the Home Office, so deputy to Frank Soskis and then later to Roy Jenkins. That's the number two minister at the Home Office and the first woman to ever be a minister at the Home Office. And although home affairs hadn't been something that Alice had particularly championed as a backbench MP, apart from on the issue of the death penalty, she took to this role with great enthusiasm. And it was a time of huge social liberal reform, first under Frank Soskis, but then particularly under Roy Jenkins. And I think Frank Soskis, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, was the first Home Secretary under whom nobody was hanged. And then Frank Soskis abolished the death penalty with a bit of help from others in 1964. And that was the first, really, of those social liberal reforms of the 1960s. And interestingly, Sidney Silverman, whose private member's bill it was that abolished the death penalty, had introduced something similar in 1948 under Clement Attlee. And Attlee and Herbert Morrison had voted against the abolition of the death penalty in 1948, but Soskis and Alice Bacon had supported it. And then as Home Secretary and Minister of State in the Home Office, they helped get that onto the statute books. But one of the reasons I think that Harold Wilson's government is perhaps overlooked in terms of its achievements is that many of its achievements were secured through private members' bills rather than through government legislation. So if you think of those big social liberal reforms of the 60s, starting with the death penalty, but also the Race Relations Act, the legalisation of abortion, the decriminalisation of homosexuality, all of those things were secured, not the Race Relations Act actually, but were secured through private members' legislation. So as some of you will know, every year there's a ballot of MPs, and if you come high up in that ballot, you have a chance to take through your own bill, not a government-sponsored bill, but your own bill through Parliament. And if you can get the support, then that gets onto the statute books. But you're very little chance of doing it without the support of government. And so Sydney Silverman on the death penalty, Leo Absey on homosexuality, and David Steele on abortion all managed, as backbench MPs, to take incredibly significant legislation through Parliament. But none of it could have been done without the support of Harold Wilson and then Frank Soskis, but I would say particularly Roy Jenkins and also Alice Bacon as Minister for State, because Minister of State. One of the people I interviewed for the book was David Steele, who took through the abortion law reform, and he spoke about the tacit support he had from ministers right away from Wilson and through the government. Because you needed time on the floor of the House, and it's up to government how to allocate time. You needed time in committee stage, but most importantly, you needed time to see off the filibusterers, because there were lots of people, even in the 1960s, who on the death penalty, abortion and homosexuality were very much against reform. And a bit like what I said before about I like to think that my party is always on the progressive side of history, there were many in the Labour Party as well who were against these sort of reforms. You had sort of three groups of members of Parliament who weren't convinced that these social liberal reforms were the right priority. That the first group of those were the MPs like Herbert Morrison, who feared that the Labour Party was going to get too far ahead of public opinion, and particularly the opinion of the white working class base of the Labour Party. That they wouldn't support these sorts of social reforms. They were more conservative with a small C in terms of their social values. Then there was the group of MPs, mainly sponsored by trade unions, who felt that the priority of a Labour government should be on economic and industrial reform rather than these sorts of social liberal change. And so they weren't supportive of reform either. And then you had a very significant group at that time of Roman Catholic MPs who not only didn't feel that this was politically the right priority, but also felt particularly on abortion that morally this wasn't the right thing. And I was just searching there for a quote from the book, and this comes from Barbara Castle's diaries, but it's a quote from George Brown, who was deputy leader of the Labour Party in the 60s under Wilson, and this is on homosexuality and the bill that was taken through Parliament to decriminalise homosexuality. And this is from a cabinet meeting, and George Brown declared that homosexuality was how Rome came down, and I care deeply about it. Don't think teenagers are able to evaluate your library ideas. You will have a totally disorganised, indecent and unpleasant society. You must have rules. We've gone too far on sex already. I don't regard any sex as pleasant. It's pretty undignified. It's pretty undignified, and I've always thought so. And he was deputy leader of the Labour Party.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And this is sort of what Jenkins and the backbenchers like Leo Absey were up against, but also Alice Bacon. And the strength that Alice Bacon brought to the Home Office, particularly under Roy Jenkins, was that she was very much in touch with the grassroots of the party, both in the country, but also in the Parliamentary Labour Party. Much closer to them than someone like Frank Soskis would have been, and indeed Roy Jenkins, who was intellectually brilliant and a great orator and a great debater, but perhaps not that good with the grassroots Labour activist or indeed with backbench MPs. Yep. As I said briefly earlier, Alice was very much regarded as being on the right of the Labour Party, along with Gaitskell and Jenkins and Soskis, and didn't get on at all well with Nyren Bevan, who of course was Health Secretary under Clement Attlee. But the one time that Bevan and Alice Bacon seemed to bond was in a throwaway conversation about Roy Jenkins. And Alice described Roy Jenkins to Clement to Nyren Bevan and said, The problem with Roy is that he's phenomenally lazy. And Iron Bevan said, anybody who works on their accent to that extent cannot be described in such terms. Because, of course, Roy Jenkins was from South Wales, a mining community. But if you listen to him, you certainly wouldn't know that. But that was Alice's strength that she could bring to the role. But also she helped lower the temperature. It was a very emotive, as we saw from that quote from George Brown, a very emotive subject, abortion and homosexuality especially. And Alice helped lower the temperature and take colleagues with her. And she sat night after night, both in the committee stage of the bill and then on the floor of the House, to ensure that these private members' bills got onto the statute books. And for that, at least, I think we owe Alice a huge debt of gratitude. She was at the Home Office for 3 years, from 1964 until 1967. And then in 1967, in that reshuffle, she was moved to the department more than anything that I think that she wanted to work in, and that was the Department for Education and Science. But she wasn't made the minister, at least at first, for schools and comprehensive education. She was made Minister for Higher Education and Science, and Shirley Williams, who was appointed to the department at the same time, was given the Schools and Comprehensive Education brief. And Shirley was one of the people I interviewed for this book. And the reason the story I'm just going to tell you, the reason I know about it is from Shirley. So pretty much straight after the reshuffle, Shirley Williams went on holiday, leaving Alice Bacon in the department. And Alice Bacon seized her opportunity and scribbled a note to the permanent secretary, so the chief civil servant in the department, and said that she thought it would make much more sense for Shirley to have responsibility for higher education, because Shirley had been a higher education lecturer, whereas Alice had only been a school teacher, and so it would make much more sense if she was the Minister for Schools and Comprehensive Education Policy. Anyway, the permanent secretary seemed happy with that explanation and agreed to move all the files between their offices, and Shirley only found out when she returned from holiday. Now, when Shirley told me this story, I think she expected me to go away with a somewhat diminished view of my heroine, but it had in fact the exact reverse effect. Because I thought, well, why not? I mean, she's the one been campaigning on it, and she's stayed around to do the work. So she should have the chance now to see through this policy that she'd been campaigning for all through the 40s and 50s, and indeed before, when she was a teacher and a member of the Socialist Education Association. So Alice really did seize her opportunity to see through this policy. Now, as I said, in 1964, comprehensive education was in Labour's manifesto, and in 1964, Anthony Crossland was appointed as the Secretary of State for Education and Science. And he started embarking on this reform of bringing comprehensive education. But what's important to know and to note is that local authorities, not central government, were responsible for how to organise education at a local level. And so to get around this, Anthony Crossland issued to local councils something called Circular 1065 in October 1965. And what Circular 1065 set out was to reaffirm that local authorities were indeed able to decide how to organise education at a local level, but if local authorities wanted more money for school buildings or new schools, they needed to reorganise education at a local level along comprehensive lines if they wanted any of that new money. Now, of course, local authorities' money is incredibly important, and in 1965 it was really important for schools, because the baby boom generation needed to be accommodated somewhere. And after the Second World War, when rationing and austerity continued for many years afterwards, the building materials that were available were mainly going into house building rather than school building. Yes. And the repairs that had been building up during the war and then beyond were in desperate need of attention. And so Anthony Crossland, through this circular, began to achieve the intentions of the 1964 manifesto. And so when Alice came into the department, work was already afoot to bring in comprehensive education. But like at the Home Office, Alice helped work with local authorities to convince them of the need for change, and also MPs, not just in the Labour Party, but across the House. And 6 years into the Labour government, at the end of the Labour government in 1970, when Labour lost office and Ted Heath became Prime Minister, the number of children being taught at comprehensive schools had increased from pretty much zero in 1964 to a third of all children by 1970. And so 3 years at the Department for Education, Alice felt very much that what she went into politics to achieve was well underway. And even in 1970, with Heath as Prime Minister and with Margaret Thatcher as Education Secretary, although they watered down Circular 1065 a bit, even by 1974, two-thirds of children were taught at comprehensive schools. So it was a reform that had achieved some degree of cross-party support, both in Parliament but also in the country, with local authorities, Labour and Conservative, beginning to reorganise education at a local level. In 1970, Alice stood down as a Member of Parliament after 25 years in the job. She was 61 years old, and she felt that she had perhaps in a way achieved what she set out to do with the comprehensive reform, but also she felt she had responsibilities that meant that she couldn't fulfil her duties as an MP. Alice never married, and she never had children. Dennis Healy, who I interviewed for the book, and was Alice's next-door neighbour MP in Leeds East, said that Alice had a touch of the Jane Eyre about her, but unlike Jane Eyre, Alice never found her Mr. Rochester, which is slightly patronising from Dennis Healy, but I think also tells you something about Alice and about her life and her priorities, but also about the sacrifices, actually, that women of that generation had to make, because Alice did sacrifice a lot for politics. Pretty much everybody I interviewed for this book said that Alice was as good as married to the Labour Party. The Labour Party was everything to Alice. Alice spent all her time in the Labour Party. Apart from her childhood, there's very little in the book about Alice's hinterland, what she did outside of politics, because there was very little that she did do outside of politics. She spent her weeks in Westminster, and she spent her weekends in the constituency, in her home in Normanton, but often touring the country in Yorkshire, visiting local Labour parties, but particularly speaking at women's section events in the party, rallying the faithful and converting others. But this was all a huge sacrifice to her own personal life. And again, Shirley Williams, who I interviewed for this book, said that certainly in that generation it was much easier for a man MP to find a partner than it was for a woman MP. Mm-hmm. There weren't very many men in the 1940s, 50s and 60s who would be willing to see their wife disappear to Westminster for the week whilst they looked after the children in the constituency. There were many more women who were willing to tolerate such a life. And so Alice, like very many women of that generation, didn't marry and didn't have children. If you take the four women who were elected in 1945 on the Labour benches, Alice Bacon, Peggy Herbertson, Barbara Castle and Jenny Lee, the four who became ministers, only two of those married, and that was Jenny Lee and Barbara Castle, but none of those four had children. So it was a sacrifice, not just one that Alice made, but very many women of that generation. And I said right at the beginning that I feel that every generation of women owes something to the generations who have gone before us. And certainly my generation of women in Parliament, and I would imagine women in most walks of life, whether it's the top of the civil service or media or business, most women now wouldn't feel they had to make that sacrifice. And I think it's because of the sacrifices that earlier women in all of those parts of society have made it a little bit easier for women today. Alice loved the party. She was devoted to it. She was on the right of the party, but for her, loyalty to the party came before anything else. In an interview in the 1980s, so towards the end of Alice's life, she died in 1993, she described that there had never been a time at which she decided to join the Labour Party. She had always been Labour. She described being Labour as natural as breathing, which I think is a beautiful expression, and probably not one that many 16-year-old girls in Normanton or anywhere else would make today. But for Alice, it really was. The Labour Party was her community. It was what her family and her community were built on. And she was as good as married to it. When the Labour Party split in the early 1980s, Alice stayed in the Labour Party. Many of those who she admired and had worked with, including Roy Jenkins and Shirley Williams, left to form the SDP. But Alice's loyalty, despite being regarded as a right-wing or a moderate Labour MP, was always very much in the party that she joined at 16, and she continued to serve all the way until her death in 1993. The purpose of this book was to write back Alice into history, but I think that there are very, very many women who should be written back into history. And I hope that I've done my job, at least, of writing this one remarkable woman back into our history. Thank you.
Thanks so much. We've got about 20 minutes or so for questions. So...
It's a great question. I'm sure if Alice had been offered a job in the cabinet, she would have taken it. And I wonder whether if Gateschool had lived and not died shortly before the 1964 general election, whether maybe she would have had that opportunity. Certainly, Hugh Gateschool promoted Alice ahead of other women, and the two of them were close politically. They were neighbours, and Alice served him also very well on the National Executive Committee, where Alice would often fight those fights, the left-right battles of the 50s in particular. So I wonder whether if Hugh Gateschool had lived, Alice might have secured a cabinet level job. Just in terms of the relationship between Gateschool and Alice, many people said that she was a little bit in love with him, and I think there's probably some truth to that. I think it was an unrequited love, and probably not a physical love in any way, but she hugely admired him, and I think a bit of Alice died as well when Hugh Gateschool died. She was very moved by it, and it had a big impact on her. When he died, there were tributes in the House of Commons by four MPs, and the four MPs were Harold Macmillan, who of course was Prime Minister, George Brown, who we've come across earlier, who was then acting leader of the Labour Party, and Jeremy Thorpe for the Liberals. And the only other MP, apart from those party leaders, to speak in that tribute debate was Alice Bacon. And she spoke in that debate of the curtains on the terraced houses, the small terraced houses on the streets of South Leeds being drawn that night, not just for a Member of Parliament, but also for a close and dear friend. And certainly for Alice, she mourned greatly the loss of Hugh Gateschool. She was surprised in 64 to be appointed as a minister by Harold Wilson, because they hadn't ever been politically that close. They had an affinity. They were both grammar school educated from Yorkshire, similar sorts of background, but politically they'd never been that close. Wilson much closer, of course, to Aneirin Bevan, resigning with him earlier on in their careers. But yes, to answer your question, of course, I mean, she would have accepted a job, but I think under Wilson she wasn't expecting it. She might have expected it under Gateschool. Yeah. So I think, you know, it is clearly, I think, demonstrably easier to become a woman MP today than it was in 1945 or at any time when Alice was a Member of Parliament. Today, a third of MPs are women, 45% in my party, a Labour Party, and there have been two female Prime Ministers, and of course there hadn't been any in Alice's time in the House of Commons. People don't expect us to stick to confined areas of policy now in Parliament. Our working conditions are much better. But of course there are still challenges to being a woman MP. Some of them are quite basic and have improved a lot, but still got a long way to go, and those are the hours that Parliament sits. So we still sit until 10 o'clock on Monday and 7 o'clock on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And so it's quite hard to combine family life and being an MP. My constituency is 200 miles away from Westminster. And so every week I have to make that journey, and I've got two young children. And so that's a challenge for me. And I still think you know, of course, male MPs have children as well, but I think there's still in society an expectation that the mothers will be around much more for the children. One of the things that Harriet Harman is campaigning on at the moment is baby leave for MPs. At the moment, there are no rules about maternity leave or paternity leave or anything like that. It's up for the MP who wants to take it to negotiate it. And your voting record will be affected if you take maternity leave. So I've had two children in the 7 years that I've been a Member of Parliament, and I took some maternity leave with both of them. When I took maternity leave with my my first child, 38 Degrees, otherwise very virtuous campaigning organisation, sent an email to all of my constituents who they had on their mailing list saying that I was one of the very few Labour MPs who hadn't bothered to turn up to a vote on something to do with the environment. Now, at that time, I had a baby who was just a few weeks old, but they hadn't bothered to look that up or inform my constituents of that. And so, you know, your voting records are affected and your constituents judge you on how you vote and how you represent them. And the proposals that Harriet Harman is putting forward is that you can have someone to vote for you during a six-month period of maternity leave. When I had my second child, or just before I had my second child, it was the 2015 general election when I was the shadow work and pension secretary. And I did a newspaper interview, and they asked me what would be the first thing I would do as if I became Secretary of State for Work and Pensions at the election. And I said the first thing I would do would be to abolish the bedroom tax. And what was more, I was going to do it before I had my baby, to show how determined I was to get this done quickly. So I thought that was a good piece of news for the electorate. But a Conservative MP phoned up the Daily Mail and said that if Ed Miliband became Prime Minister, he shouldn't appoint me to be in the cabinet, because my little brain wouldn't be able to concentrate on both being a new parent and having this senior job. Now, when Gordon Brown, Tony Blair and David Cameron were Prime Ministers, they all had new babies when they were in number 10. And I don't remember anybody suggesting that they should stand down for a bit, you know, because, you know, these sleepless nights and nappy changing would interfere with the, you know, holding office of state. And so I think there is still this sort of... And so I thought, for, you know, crying out loud, I was then doing something on LBC radio that evening about, not about this issue, about something else. No, I turned up half an hour beforehand at the studio, and there was a phone-in about me, a phone-in about whether I should be appointed to the cabinet. And people were actually phoning in with their views on it, never having met me, knowing nothing about me, phoning up just saying, I don't think she should do this. I think it'd be a mistake. And then other people just saying, no, she's got to do it. It's really important. It's just, this is ridiculous. In 2015, we're debating whether a pregnant woman should be able to carry on in her job or not. So there are still challenges today in terms of attitudes in Parliament, but also outside, I think, as well. And then, you know, perhaps more seriously, there are the allegations and the stories in the last few weeks about sexual harassment in Parliament. And there certainly is a lot of the low-level underlying sexism and chauvinism and way of talking to and judging women that you see from MPs. Again, not just on the opposite benches from me, but on our side, my side as well. And of course, you know, the stories in the last few weeks go much beyond that, about sexual harassment and those behaviours, which are clearly unacceptable, but are clearly far too common in politics than they should be. Now, I've been an MP for 7 years, and I worked in banking and financial services before that. I don't think that politics is unique in having issues of sexual harassment and discrimination. But in politics, I think we should hold ourselves to a higher standard, because we are there to uphold the laws and to make the laws. And also we have a role as role models and as representatives of the people who we are supposed to serve. But also in politics lies power, and it is power that is often used to undermine, and also power can be abused. And where there is power, there is probably always likely to be some sort of abuse. But then there's even a greater responsibility for those of us there to hold people to account. And so I'm pleased that a spotlight is now being shone on these issues. And I hope, in a way that I spoke about previous generations making it a bit easier for the next generation, I hope that my generation will help stamp out this harassment and discrimination to make it easier for the next generation still to come through to Parliament. But, you know, some of the challenges are very different from when Alice and that first generation and second generation of women were in Parliament. But I think some of those assumptions and attitudes, sadly, are still with us. And, you know, every generation of women, every generation of people have to fight for more progress and to stop the clock being turned back too.
Yes.
The 1964 election was actually the first one which I can remember very hazily, mainly because my form master was a digression, making it very clear that Wilson and Brown coming to power was a very bad thing. your description of the relationship between Jenkins and Alice Bacon in the Home Office was actually very interesting, because I had read the huge biography last year of Roy Jenkins. I was just wondering whether you said she was on the right wing of the party, whether her coming behind these private members' bills on abortion and divorce in particular, because she actually had particular knowledge by her constituencies being a woman which male MPs would not have had. My mother, who's of the same generation, knew a great deal about abortion, which was
Yeah, so certainly most of the legislation that have improved the lives of women have in Parliament have been led by women. The abortion law, I think, is the exception to that, because it was very much David Steele's bill, and then Roy Jenkins was the key figure. However, there were women like Renee Short, who was an MP in Wolverhampton, and Alice Bacon, who championed these issues. And the Abortion Law Reform Association very much regarded Alice as a supporter of theirs. When I've interviewed people in the constituency, and I've mentioned these social liberal reforms of the 60s, they don't remember Alice talking about them very much as a local MP. They associate her very much with the comprehensive policy reforms and also on improving the housing conditions in Leeds. They don't remember her being a great advocate for this and speaking about it with constituents. And so I'm not totally sure of that. The death penalty, she in 1959, I think, had introduced her own private members' bill on abolishing the death penalty, but it hadn't succeeded. It hadn't been given the time to go through in the way that Labour had allowed that time for Sidney Silverman's bill just a few years later. So it was on the death penalty she definitely had history, on abortion and homosexuality less so. I think that on abortion, though, I think it was a class issue as well as a feminist issue, and I think that appealed to Anna, to Alice. I think in part because if you're a middle class, if you're a well off woman, you could procure an abortion. You could either go abroad, or you could get a doctor to perform an abortion under a different name. It was as working class women that it was you had to turn to a backstreet abortionist, and then there were many deaths and complications, and that was something that David Steele spoke about when he introduced his private members' bill. He said, if anyone who opposes my bill can come up with a better means of reducing the number of women having backstreet abortions and all the rest of it, then, you know, come forward. But I can't see any other way of addressing this problem and this, you know, very real phenomenon. And I think Alice very much came as a class issue as well as a women's issue per se. And I think that was important for a lot of those Labour women of that generation. As I said at the beginning, Alice didn't want to be seen as a woman's MP. She said, "Judge me as a socialist, not as a feminist." And I think it was the social and the class dimension of it that appealed as well to a lot of the Labour members.
Yes.
So I'm just curious. You spoke a little bit about how Alice Bacon's her selection and selection of other
they weren't expected to win, and that for the seats where, you know, certain parties are trying to win and will put up a safer candidate, if you will. How does a party in the modern day go about combating that sort of social status quo and to actively push for more diverse representation in its party membership, and in other ways as well? How do you continue to push for social advancement?
Mm-hmm. So all parties have tried over the years to boost number of women and the diversity of Parliament. When I was born almost 40 years ago, there were less than 40 women in Parliament. Today, as I say, a third of us are women. I think 208 MPs today are women. In the 7 years I've been an MP, the proportion has gone up from 21% to a third. So we're seeing good progress in the last few years. Interestingly, I said there were 15 new women elected in 45. You didn't have as many new women return to Parliament again until 1992. So, you know, all those years up until 1992, the numbers of women in Parliament sort of stayed around the 20s, 30s. You know, it really wasn't until the early 90s that you started really boosting the number of women in Parliament. Now, in my party, the key to getting more women in Parliament has been women-only shortlists, which are controversial, but they have been hugely successful in a way that no other party has been. So we've got 45% in the Labour Party now, women. The Conservatives have, I think, maybe just over 20%. More than half of all the women ever elected to Parliament have been Labour, despite the fact that we haven't been in government nearly as much as the Conservatives during that period. Now, all women shortlists, I was elected on an all women shortlist. My constituency actually wanted an all women shortlist because they felt very keenly that it was about time Leeds got another woman MP for the reasons that I described earlier. But I think without women only shortlists, what people tend to look for is somebody like the MP they most admire. Now, in Leeds West, when I was selected, John Battle, my predecessor, was an MP for 23 years, incredibly popular. Very good man. I expect a lot of people would have tried to find a new John Battle, and I am very different from John Battle. We get on very well, but our approach to things, our gender, our policies, our priorities, we're just very, very different. Or they would have thought of the other MPs in Leeds. People like Hugh Gateschall, Dennis Healy, Merlin Rees, Hilary Benn, more recently, my next-door neighbour MP. They would have looked for an MP who looked like somebody else they admired, and there aren't very many women to base your admiration or your choice on. And so it's about breaking through that. If you also think about the routes through which people come to Parliament, now it's different in different parties, but in the Labour Party it is primarily through the following three routes: local government, trade unions, or political advisers. All of them, still today, but certainly 10, 20 years ago, incredibly male-dominated. Trade unions are still incredibly male-dominated. Councils getting better, but still a lot more male councils and a lot more male council leaders. Often council leaders then become the local MP. And parliamentary researchers, and especially advisers to shadow cabinets and cabinets, very male-dominated. And so it's about trying to break through that and get women in. Now, you know, I hope that eventually you won't need women-only shortlists, but I still think at the moment it is a necessary way of breaking through that threshold. Interestingly, I think that having women-only shortlists has also resulted in all types of diversity in Parliament increasing. So when I was elected in 2010, the first ever Muslim women were returned to Parliament, and there were three of them that year. Politics on all sides of the House look much more diverse than when I was born, and even when I was elected 7 years ago, in terms of disability, race, religion, and gender. And I think that's a really good thing, and I think that all women shortlists have helped encourage other types of diversity. All parties have mentoring schemes, training schemes. We have the Labour Women's Network. The Conservatives have Women to Win. And I imagine that the Lib Dems and the SNP have similar things. And they all work and try and build up that pipeline, get those women the confidence and the experience to stand. But you've also got to do something about the demand side. How do you get Conservative associations and constituency Labour parties to select women? And Labour have done that through all women's shortlists.
Can I ask sort of one last question, maybe? I find it really... really fascinating looking at this sort of whole history of as Bacon from the late 30s through to 1970, but it's as though from the book and from your talk, as Bacon really saw herself this is really a question, did she see herself as someone who was really deeply integrated into party organisation and concerned that the organisation of the party worked effectively for the party leader up to 64. But then she moves over into this really active and very impressive role, actually, as a policymaker. Or did she always see herself as a policymaker, and that's not a right way of thinking about it.
No. I think even when she was a minister, she was all about getting things done.
Yes.
Apart from on the issue of education, where she really was very, very passionate, and it wasn't just, you know, she was happy with the Labour idea, she was always pushing to go further. I would say on policy, she was quite radical, but politically she was pragmatic and moderate in the party. Again, Shirley Williams described Alice as being an administrator and not an innovator. And again, Shirley meant this as a criticism rather than a compliment. But actually, you could take it the other way, because politics needs administrators, it needs people who get things done. I would argue that you'd struggle to get radical legislation on the statute books without people thinking about the practicalities. So you needed Roy Jenkins or somebody like him to get that social liberal reform through. And you needed those backbench MPs with the vivacity and the single-mindedness to take through those bills. But also to get, if we take abortion, because that's the one that I've done most work on, because David Steele very generously allowed me to interview him for the book. He said, yes, he needed someone like Jenkins, but you also needed Alice, because you weren't going to have Jenkins sitting night after night in the committee stages of the bill. But also you needed the Chief Whip, who was John Silkin at the time. You needed the Leader of the House, Dick Crossman, at the time. You needed all of them to ensure that... So in Parliament, you've got a certain number of hours, and it's up to Parliament, the government, how to allocate those hours. So you can have a private member's bill, but if the government decide there's no time to debate that private member's bill, or it only has a day in committee, it won't get anywhere. Yeah. And what John Silkin as the Labour Chief Whip and Dick Crossman did as Leader of the House is they made it very clear to the filibusterers that however long it was going to take, they were going to allow the time for this to get on the statute books. So there's no point in then talking it out another day and another week. They were going to sit it out and provide the time. And that was really, really important. And so the administration was incredibly important to get the radical reform through. And so I think Alice was an administrator, even in government and even in those policy briefs. But the administrative work helped. And it's probably one of the reasons why she's written out of history, because she's not a Roy Jenkins or an Anthony Crossland. But I would say, especially on comprehensive education, she was more important than Anthony Crossland in reforming Labour's policy on education, even though he was the Secretary of State who issued that circular to get it moving. It wouldn't have happened without that relentless pressure by Alice and a few others, but primarily Alice over all those years.
Well, let me first of all, I think the book, which is really, really, really interesting book to read. And now your marvellous talk totally brings Alice Bacon to life, but absolutely underlines her huge importance in politics. And one sort of wonders how easy would it have been for Gateskill, particularly if she hadn't been there to really sort of make sure everything was all right. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you, David.
And now you get going to sign and sell books.
Yes, and chat to people outside if you want
to chat to people outside. So
thank you.